Two Powers, Two Expressivism, and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh, and thanks everybody for coming. This talk is a bit of a kind of conceptual cartography talk, so I want to work through what I see as two paths to expressivism and then talk a little bit about what might be a path beyond. I'll start with a kind of orientating quote from Sellars. This is, I think, just the mirror quote that from Mike Williams' paper yesterday. Sellars says, it's almost transposed, but I looked back at the paper last night because I thought maybe he only said the thing about causation and not the thing about ought, but he says both, and they're almost exactly the same thing. But he says, now, once it's granted that empiricism in moral philosophy is compatible with the recognition that ought has as distinguished a role in discourse as descriptive and logical terms, and once the tautology, the world, is described by the descriptive concepts, is freed from the idea that the business of all non-logical concepts is to describe, the way is clear to ungrudging recognition that many expressions, which empiricists have relegated to second-class citizenship in discourse, are not inferior, just different. This is an orientating quote for the talk, but also for the book project that I'm working on more generally, which is about the meaning of ought. And I guess in one way to see the thesis that I'm working towards in that book is that the meaning of ought is not inferior to the meaning of descriptive terms, but just different, and then trying to cash out the way in which it's different. I think over the past 50 years or so, it's meta-ethical expressivists who've done the most to try to articulate the way in which the meaning of the word ought is different, and I'm influenced by meta-ethical expressivists, but I see myself as not quite doing the same thing that they're doing. So let me start out with a kind of vague characterization of meta-ethical expressivism, and then I'll give you a plan for how I'm going to talk through the issues after that. So meta-ethical expressivism vaguely stated two core claims. First, that there's a philosophically important difference between what is expressed by claims which essentially just deploy some target vocabulary. So originally this was something like moral vocabulary, but it's been more common recently to extend it to normative vocabulary. So there's a difference between those claims and the claims that we might more naturally think of as core parts of the practice of describing states of affairs in the world. So traditionally, the home vocabulary, the non-inferior vocabulary were empirical vocabularies, or we might think more broadly of matter-factual vocabularies. So expressivists have typically insisted on a contrast between these two types of vocabularies. But that's not enough, because I think a lot of people think that there is some contrast between those, some philosophically interesting contrast between those two vocabularies, or two sets of vocabularies. But expressivists go further and say that this contrast is important enough that if you fail to implicitly track it, you don't count as fully understanding the meaning of the target vocabulary. So if you fail to track the way in which, and now I haven't really said much about what that way is, but the way in which these different vocabularies are different, then you don't count as understanding moral or normative vocabulary. So this is why expressivism is typically seen as an anti-descriptivist account of the meaning of some target vocabulary, like that used in moral or normative discourse. So this is a kind of vague characterization that I'll then slot in a couple different kinds of expressivism and then talk about different ways we might go afterwards. Here's the plan. So I want to start with just a very brief comment about some familiar territory about the failings of the proto-expressivist views of air and hair. I see this as proto-expressivist because they don't really focus on the notion of what's expressed in giving the type of account they give, but they still want to insist on this kind of distinction between moral or normative vocabularies and other vocabularies. The problem in general is the Frege-Geech problem, but I have a kind of more specific way of thinking about it that'll be relevant for what follows. Then I want to distinguish two paths I see to the expressivist views that come in the wake of the air, hair, and then Geech dialectic views, which attempt to overcome some of the problems with the proto-expressivist views. I think there's two separate paths that often get run together in the normative case, and by distinguishing them, we can see better their theoretical benefits and liabilities, but also, and I'll use this kind of as a test case, we can see how well they might extend to modal vocabularies And so I think once we distinguish these two things, the picture looks different when you start to ask about expressivism, about various modal vocabularies. And then finally, I want to use reflection on this modal case to take some initial steps on what I see as a path towards something that's sort of beyond expressivism that we might apply back both in the modal case and I think, and this is where I'm going in the book, in the normative case, at least when it comes to normative modals. So that's the plan for the talk. Just to start out, a lot of people have talked about the Frege-Gitsch problem and Ayer's emotivism. I just want to put kind of one quick point on the table that I think gets at least the heart of a very a central problem that's relevant to the whole the kind of constellation of problems that Gitsch brought up. This comes from the fact that, I mean, just as part of his emotivism, Ayer famously claimed that unlike empirical vocabularies, moral vocabularies don't affect the propositional content of the sentence in which they occur, but they do something else. They add to its emotive tone or its coloring in some way. So this is why he thought that sort of a sentence like Sally will help, or the sentence it's not the case that Sally will help, Ayer is quite happy to assign those propositions as their semantic content, and then he has a view about the nature of those propositions, verificationist view of meaning, but he'll say these sentences express propositions, and in fact, these sentences just express contradictory propositions. That's fine as far as Ayer's view goes. But for moral sentences like Sally ought to help, or it's not the case that Sally ought to help, Ayer's going to not assign those propositions of their semantic content. In fact, I think Ayer's committed to thinking those sentences have exactly the same semantic content, namely, none at all. Those sentences don't get assigned propositions. They have no, as he puts it, factual meaning. They just express emotive attitudes of some sort or another. And I think he thinks of that as something different than the propositional contents. Now, here's why I think this just can't be right. If you just look at these two sentences from the point of view of a theoretical semanticist who's seeking to assign contents to these sentences in a systematic way that can explain the way that the parts of the sentences composed to give you the semantic content of the whole, these sentences look very similar. It seems like we're going to use very similar functions to give a content to a sentence like 1 and 3. The only difference between them is whether you use the word will or whether you use the word ought. And likewise with 2 and 4, 4 looks to be the negation of 3, just like 2 looks to be the negation of 1. So it seems to be clearly unacceptable from the point of view of theoretical semantics to assign contents to propositional contents to the first two, but assign no contents at all to the second two. One of the central goals of theoretical semantics is to develop a systematic way to assign contents to whole sentences based on the semantic values we assign to the parts and the way these parts are put together by the sentence. I don't think that requires any stance on whether you're working sort of up from the parts to the whole or down from the whole to the parts. There still has to be some systematic function between parts and wholes. That's what theoretical semantics tries to do in order to explain various semantic, or at least apparently semantic, properties of our words and sentences, such as incompatibility, entailment, and synonymy. So it looks like Ayer's starting point that the moral sentences express no propositions, but the matter-factual sentences do, just sort of closes off to him the ability to engage in this this project. He looks like he's fine with the kind of straightforward propositional semantics for matter-factual claims, but he makes these claims about moral claims that look very implausible from the point of view of looking at these sentences systematically and understanding how they their contents are composed. I think it's because of that. I mean, the Frege-Gitsch problem sort of highlights that in a particular way, highlights that by looking at the way the sentences are embedded in conditionals. But actually, in Gitsch's original article, he's not just concerned with embedding in conditionals. He's also concerned with things like embedding in questions and negations and stuff like that. But it's because of that kind of, sense in which Ayer has nothing interesting to say about the semantic contrast between 3 and 4, the moral sentence and its negation, that Hare's view is often seen as an improvement. Hare, like Ayer, agrees that the matter of factual sentences like 1 and 2 get assigned propositions that we can think of as composed in systematic ways. He says that we should understand those in terms of their truth conditions. But he gives a different story. So it's not that he gives no story or a completely debunking story like Ayer. He gives a different story about the normative sentences. He says they should be assigned, they're prescriptive, so they should be assigned satisfaction conditions rather than truth conditions. So he'll say 1 and 2 express incompatible propositions, but 3 and 4 express incompatible prescriptions. The former have incompatible truth conditions, the latter have incompatible satisfaction conditions. This is better, but it's not that good. I'll skip over. There's one kind of objection I have to it, but even if he ends up being able to assign contents to normative sentences in a systematic way, it becomes hard to see how he holds on to a kind of general systematicity in the approach to assigning contents to things that look like they have the same logical form. So if you compare 6 and 7, these look very similar. If someone else isn't going to do it, then Sally ought to help. If someone else isn't going to do it, then Sally will help. The if-then here looks like it's playing a very similar function, but Hare's story for the semantic content of these two sentences is fairly starkly bifurcated. The former sentence gets assigned a proposition, a conditional proposition, what you expect. The latter sentence gets assigned a prescription. It's a little bit hard to say what prescription that is. And then if you start to embed normative sentences with non-normative sentences in more and more logically complex sentences, it becomes even more difficult to say what exactly the prescriptive content would be. So I think it's in the wake of this kind of problem with developing a systematic semantics that takes seriously the idea that semantic contents of wholes can be depicted or represented as a systematic function of the semantic content of parts and the way those parts are put together, that leads to contemporary expressivism, leads to attempts to try to develop a global semantics or global picture of meaning that that has room for the kind of distinction that Hare and Ayer wanted to make. So Hare and Ayer, I think, are quite happy to say, oh, we deal with matter-factual sentences one way, and we deal with moral or normative sentences another way, and they don't seem to be too worried about how we deal with them, how we combine the two stories, either generally or in particular sentences that seem like they combine both elements. Whereas I think contemporary expressivists are exercised by that problem and want to come up with something different. So what I want to do now is outline two paths to the view that I think a lot of people think of as meta-ethical expressivism. The first path is one where we combine, and this is maybe the more familiar path in the meta-ethics literature, maybe not in this room, but in the meta-ethics literature, the first path is one where we combine two controversial but independently motivated claims. So following Hume, the meta-ethical expressivists say we must distinguish between belief-like and desire-like attitudes. These are kind of a fundamental distinction in two different types of mental states. We can distinguish them in terms of their direction of fit with the world. And in the psychological explanation of motivation to action, we'll have to appeal to some interaction between the belief-like states and the desire-like states. And because expressivists are typically some kind of motivational internalists, they think that in making the normative claim, there's some sort of internal connection of motivation. They tend to think that the normative claim will be one that lines up with the desire-like state rather than the belief-like state. And then the second claim is a claim about how to do semantics. So following Locke and maybe also Grice, the expressivist says we should articulate the contents of any claim, any sentence, in terms of the state of mind it expresses. So we should explain sayables in terms of some thinkable, or we should articulate the contents of sayables in terms of the contents of thinkables. So the idea then is that as far as the projects of theoretical semantics go, we can assign all sentences, not a proposition as its content, as Geech was sort of assuming and as it's a more traditional view. We can rather assign all sentences a mental state type, and then we can talk about both a difference in the content of those mental state types and a difference in types of mental states in order to capture that original distinction. So by approaching all of language, or at least all of declarative language, uniformly, we avoid the Aryan and Herrian bifurcation of the two sort of sides of matter, factual, and normative. But at the same time, we can hold out for the idea that logically simple normative sentences get assigned an essentially desire-like attitude, whereas logically simple matter-factual sentences will be assigned a belief-like attitude. But if we're using a kind of global, as I'll call it, ideational semantics, then both of those feed into our general picture about how to assign contents to logically complex sentences, and the details are complicated about how to do that. But the general idea is that this way of approaching semantics, this sort of non-standard, non-propositionalist way of approaching semantics, gives us a room for the expressivist, anti-descriptivist theory of the meaning of normative claims. So somebody who I think is most clearly in this way or has taken this path towards expressivism is Alan Gibbard. So I'll just quote from him a little bit to show where I think he sort of commits himself to this way of thinking about expressivism. There's a bunch of other quotes where he says very similar things, but here we go. The label expressivism alludes to a way of explaining the meanings of statements in a public language. Holmes tells Mrs. Hudson, packing is now the thing to do, and we explain what he means by explaining the state of mind that he thereby expresses. Expressing, we explain by analogy with prosaically factual statements. Suppose Holmes said instead, Moriarty will shortly arrive. He will thereby express a prosaically factual belief, his belief that Moriarty will shortly arrive. Expressing a state of mind works the same in both of these two cases. And I think Gibbard's thinking that, and that determines their semantic content. But the state of mind expressed is different. In the one case, it's a plan-like state, which is going to class as a desire, and the belief-desired Humean distinction, whereas in another case, it's a belief-like state. So as I see it, the basic program here is to insist on the Humean distinction between belief and desire, like states of mind, to say that the normative claims express, at least in part, an essentially desire-like state of mind. Combine that with a global ideationalism about how to do semantics, how to assign semantic contents in a systematic way that respects the logical form of the different sentences. And then I think this is maybe more Gibbard than other people in this camp, but Gibbard also wants to insist that we should ultimately understand semantic relations like incompatibility and entailment and synonymy, not in terms of some primitive difference between true and false propositions, but instead in terms of some primitive difference between agreeing and disagreeing mental states. And so that becomes the foundations for his ideationalist semantics. So I think for a lot of metaethicists, that seems to be the main picture. And just to kind of highlight the way that that's the main picture, a lot of people are thinking expressivist, or the main path that a lot of people are thinking expressivist take. I want to talk about a recently very influential criticism of expressivism due to Mark Schroeder. I won't go through Schroeder's detailed and very subtle and sometimes ingenious criticism of different moves and possible moves one can make in trying to work out an ideationalist semantics that has the formal resources to articulate in a systematic way the contents of arbitrary sentences of a language. It gets really complicated. His book is commendable for working through the complicated details in a clear way. But I just want to point out the way he's thinking about expressivism. Following and drawing on Geach and Hale and Unwin and Dreyer and some other people, he develops a sustained critique of the ability of expressivists to provide a plausible systematic semantics for indicative sentences quite generally. And his core conclusion, which is just what's important here, is as follows. An expressivist view according to which normative language and descriptive language work in the same way can solve a lot of the traditional problems of non-cognitivism. He calls this, at a different part of the book, the basic expressivist mover, so the maneuver. So the idea is that expressivists think language works in the same way. They just want to make it so normative and matter-factual language works the same way, expresses states of mind, and that's how we understand its semantics. But they want to make a distinction in the psychology about the nature of the state of mind expressed, and that distinction is going to be relevant to the way that ideational semantics works. And that's going to overcome the kind of problems that we, I very briefly alluded to with Aaron Hare, but he goes into more detail about. He goes on, but none of these advantages come by taking what we know about descriptive language and applying it to normative language. They all require drawing progressively more radical conclusions about how ordinary descriptive language works. This is something he argues for in great detail in the book. That's one of my most important morals for this book. It's not, I think, an entirely new moral, but I've done my best to make it vivid, and I think that unlike previous treatments, my observations, and this is the key, my observations follow from a fully general understanding of what expressivism must be like. And his understanding of what expressivism must be like is essentially this first path to expressivism that I've just articulated. So you combine Humean distinction between belief and desire-like states of mind with an ideationalist approach to semantics, and that's your expressivism. And he criticizes that and takes that to be a criticism of what expressivism is quite generally. So I want to basically say I think a lot of the criticisms that he makes are apt, but there's another path to expressivism that has nothing really to do with the two commitments that lead to the path that Schroeder ultimately criticizes. This path starts out from two different controversial but independently motivatable or motivated ideas. And sometimes I think in the normative case it's run together because you could see Hume as the inspiration in this case as well. But it's not really Hume on morality, it's more Hume on modality, and the point is also a point that I think is taken up in Kant and Wittgenstein and Ramsey and Sellers and a lot of other people. And the point is something like we should endorse or accept a kind of functional pluralism about the various kinds of states of mind that we have, and kinds of thoughts that we have. So in addition to, or maybe even not including, but in addition to cognitive representations of reality and pressures on action, we should also recognize expectations, degrees of confidence, limits on conceivability, maybe even pure ideas reflecting something like the nature of our conceptual framework. So you get not just this stark distinction between belief-like and desire-like states of mind, but a pluralism of a bunch of different kinds of states of mind and different kinds of concepts. And then rather than feeding that directly into a semantic articulation of the content of the various claims, you follow a minimalist about truth in rejecting metaphysically inflationary interpretations of the core notions of theoretical semantics. So this is familiar, I think, to a lot of people in the room. Mainly you refuse any kind of metaphysically inflationary interpretation of the notion of proposition or truth condition or denotation or predication. You can see all of these as tools in developing theoretical semantic models that that help us to explain certain sorts of semantic phenomena like entailment relations and synonymy relations and inconsistency relations and things like that. But you don't interpret that model as committing you to any particular relation between those words and the world. So all sentences then can be assigned semantically decomposable propositions as their semantic contents. You can use, I think, standard theoretical semantics to explain the compositional possibilities of both normative and matter-factual sentences, and when they combine, and other sentences as well, embedding and modals, things like that. But that's going to be a kind of universal, non-bifurcated approach to semantics, and I think that also helps to avoid Schroeder's critique. But logically simple normative sentences will be said to allow us to do something different than describe reality. They'll be said to allow us to express a state of mind with some different function than cognitively representing the world. Now, I think the reason that these two paths to expressivism often get run together is that in the normative case, the thing that the expressivist along my second path wants to say is very similar to what someone like Gibbard wants to say. What they allow us to do is to express some motivational pressure on action. That's a very rough picture, but it's something like that. So it looks like the same view, but I think it's you reach that point by a kind of radically different path, a path that recognizes functional pluralism rather than the belief-desire distinction starkly conceived, and approaches semantics in this deflated or minimalist way rather than using an ideationalist alternative semantics. So I think somebody who's less clear than Gibbard that he goes the second way but still I like to interpret this on the second path is Blackburn. And so here's just a few quotes to place Blackburn. To understand the role of a term in our language, we need some understanding of its compositional possibilities. Now, if you're Gibbard, you would say, yeah, we need to explain that in terms of the state of mind they express or they help us to express. But Blackburn says, however, that explaining their compositional possibilities is a relatively internal inquiry into the way meanings are generated in a particular language, which contrasts with external surrounding questions, which success in the compositional semantics would evidently leave untouched. And I see him as wanting to bring his expressivism in this at the what he's now here calling the external level. You can recognize a compositional propositional semantics, but then you leave a deeper question about why the various sentences have the propositional contents that they do untouched. In the latter case, we are interested in questions about what it is for a group, what it is about a group of people that make it true that they are speaking and understanding a language, which fits a particular semantic description of what counts as change in this language, sameness in this language, understanding the language in a certain way. But in all cases, you get the semantic description, the theoretical semantics, can stay the same, and then you get competing explanations of why it is the way that it is. So the basic program here, just to contrast with what I put into Gibbard's mouth and then showed that Schroeder was criticizing, is to insist on a pluralism about functional roles of mental states and concepts, insist on an anti-inflationary stance towards core semantic notions like proposition, truth conditions, etc., and then to use anthropological or genealogical reflections in order to understand the important, the import of various functional roles and meanings of various vocabulary. So you articulate that difference that expressivists want, that Ayer and Hare wanted, not in terms of a difference in semantic content, but a difference in this deeper external question about why the sentences have the semantic content that they do. A popular counter-argument or worry about this could be put as follows, and I'm going to use some of Hugh's work to explain why I think that this can be put aside. So the argument would go, according to minimalism, any sentence embeddable in the truth predicate can be used to make an assertion or express a belief, and the only thing that could distinguish assertions or beliefs from other utterances or mental states is their direction of fit with the world. So that means that although mental states expressed by normative claims may have other functional roles like motivations to action, minimalism forces one to grant that these claims are also descriptive, pace expressivism. So I think that's a kind of popular response to this second path to expressivism. Here's Hugh's response, as far as I understand it, and also just very briefly characterized. While we shouldn't think that embeddability in the truth predicate is a mere syntactic criterion, or we shouldn't think of what it takes to be embeddable in the truth predicate as merely a matter of syntax, mere declarative syntax gets you embeddability in the truth predicate, we have to think that when one's making a claim with that sentence is subject to certain norms. So this is the truth is convenient friction idea. And then we think of assertions and the beliefs that they express as distinguishable from other utterances in mental states in virtue of their central and special role in the practice that Brandom calls giving and asking for reasons. So roughly speaking, an assertion is going to be something for which you can give and ask for reasons in the way that's characteristic of the truth norm in thinking of truth as convenient friction. So it's no good just to plead sincerity or even plead personal warrant. You have to also plead, you have to give reasons when asked for reasons, or at least you're subject to the demand to give reasons when asked for reasons that interact with the person demanding the reasons. So I think that's a kind of nice way to respond to the worry that, well, as soon as you go in for minimalism, you're going to just make expressivism unintelligible, off the table, because you'll have to say that these claims are all expressive of beliefs and then have a belief-like direction of fit with the world and so are descriptive. I think there's a residual worry about this response, which is that it might eliminate the line that expressivists originally wanted to draw between descriptive and non-descriptive vocabularies. I think, personally, I'm not so worried about drawing the line in a different place. I would be worried about eliminating the line quite generally. I'm not quite sure the best way to draw the line. I think Hugh sometimes wants to eliminate the line and sometimes wants to draw the line in a different place or with different resources. So this is a place where I think we need to think more in more detail about how to draw the line or what kind of line we want. I'll leave that residual worry because I'll kind of come back to it later. So just to kind of sum up where I've gone and then take you hopefully a little bit beyond. expressivism is usually seen as an anti-descriptivist account of the meaning of some target vocabulary or area of discourse. And it seems to me that there's two places that in meta-ethics that expressivists engage the theory of meaning. The first place is at a kind of narrowly semantic level where we're seeking to assign semantic contents to arbitrary sentences of the language in a systematic way that reflects their logical form. And then there's a broader meta-semantic level at which we seek to explain why particular kinds of sentences have the contents that they do. And my terminology here, semantic versus meta-semantic, I think I often get a lot of pushback on that. You could call both of these semantic if you want. It's just that they're two different questions. One's a question in, I think, theoretical semantics about how best to assign contents in a way that displays their compositional potential based on their logical form, or maybe even more broadly, their syntactic form. I think you can do that while leaving open certain questions about why it is that the various parts and wholes have the meanings that they do. And that's what I'm calling this, the meta-semantic question. But if you want to call both of them semantic, they're just semantic in a narrow sense and semantic in a wide sense. The first path to expressivism, I've claimed, combines a Humean belief desire bifurcation with an ideationalist approach to this narrow semantic question. And this is why I think we see Gibbard expending a lot of energy and intelligence on coming up with a way of developing a semantic model that has all the same resources as the semantic models that a kind of more straightforward truth conditionalist possible world semantics would have, but with room to make his key distinction. On the other hand, as I see it, the liabilities of this is that it runs into the kind of criticism that that Schroeder's book articulates. And then also, I'm not sure that the two commitments here are ones that we want to undertake. So I'm not sure that the Humean belief desire, stark belief desire bifurcation is ultimately defensible in the philosophy of action and moral psychology. And also, I think that there are, and this may be my deepest worry, is that there's problems with thinking that we could explain contents of sayables wholly in terms of contents of thinkables. The second path, on the other hand, is one which combines pluralism about functional roles of various beliefs and concepts and an anti-deflationary meta-semantic interpretation of standard propositional semantics. So as I see things, the first path is engaging the theory of meaning here, and the second path is engaging the theory of meaning there. This has the liability of perhaps eliding the original distinction or making us find a new way to draw the original distinction, maybe even new places. Plus, you might think that the anti-deflationary interpretation of core semantic notions like truth conditions and propositions is itself subject to criticism. I'm much more sympathetic to that than I am to the ideationalist approach, but I think some people think that that's controversial. Okay, so how might we extend this to, or could we extend this to modal expressivism? Some philosophers, of course, want, and we've seen so far here in the conference, that some philosophers want to draw a similar philosophically important distinction between what is expressed by claims, which essentially deploying modal vocabulary, like it's necessary that, or it's probable that, or must, or should, and the claims we might more naturally think of as core parts of the practice of describing states of affairs in the world. So that was the kind of original contrast, but I put in normative. Now we have modal, and I think, again, we see people who want to draw this contrast. Should we use one of these expressivist programs to try to do so? Well, I think maybe, but we have to be much more careful for two reasons. First, some modal vocabularies might be core parts of the practice of describing states of affairs in the world. So this has come out quite a bit in some of the recent talks. I mean, the the practice of describing states of affairs in the world seems to be tied up with talk of causal and physical necessity. It's not clear that in using causal and physical necessity claims, we're describing causal and physical necessity facts, but it might be something that you already have to be able to do, use causal and physical necessity claims, if you're able to describe it all. That's the Kant-Sellars thesis. At the same time, other types of motor vocabularies, epistemic motor vocabularies or deontic motor vocabularies, might not be caught up in that. So extending it whole hog across all of the different modalities is going to be something that we need to approach with care. Second, some motor vocabularies might be core parts of the practice of describing the world, but only because they articulate features of the framework of all conceptual activity whatsoever, or the framework of empirical description, überhaupt. So I think if we're going to extend expressivism to the modal range, we need to be careful about exactly how we're doing the extension, how much of the various kinds of modality we want to incorporate in the extension, and we need to think about the various roles within descriptive discourse when thinking about modality. So with those caveats, I think maybe we could extend expressivism to modality or modal notions, or at least some modal notions. But if we're going to do so, I think the second path expressivism is going to look like a better way to do so. So you don't need to insist that modal claims express desire-like pressures on action. You just need to insist that there's a plurality of different types of functional roles of concepts and beliefs, and the ones that are linked up with modal claims are different than the ones that are linked up with descriptive claims. Modal claims are not linked up with cognitive representations of reality, like descriptive claims are linked up with cognitive representations of reality. That's a really, I think, a much more neutral or weak claim than the thought that you could take Gibbard's expressivism and apply it to modality, where you think that modal claims express plans of some sort. I think that's a strong claim that's open to a lot of objection. But still, like I said at the beginning, I think we might need to go somewhere else. So let me conclude the paper by kind of outlining the beginning steps of an alternative approach that I see as neither descriptivist nor expressivist, although you'll see that it takes obvious inspiration from expressivism. So what if the original distinction we wanted to draw was not, as Ayer did, between moral claims and descriptive claims, but instead one between logical terms and descriptive terms, as you might have thought early Wittgenstein did? So you might think that, look, logical terms, they play an essentially different role in our discourse than descriptive terms do. Of course, they're both caught up in all sorts of the same sentences, but the role they play in the sentences is different. We could, of course, fashion a logical expressivism, which sought some philosophically interesting distinction between what is expressed by claims essentially deploying logical vocabulary and those deploying only descriptive vocabulary. I think that's fine if you want to do that, but note that the sense of express here is going to be radically different than the sense of express that is at issue in metaethical expressivism. It's not going to be something having to do with the externalization of what's internal, which I think is common to both Gibbard and Blackburn, although they deploy it at different levels of the theory of meaning. Instead, we'll need something like making explicit what's implicit, to use Bob's phrase. So you're going to get this difference, and I should say that this distinction between two different senses of express is one that I take from articulating reasons. We have both senses of express, making external what's internal, but also making explicit what's implicit. Moreover, the anthropological and genealogical explanation of why logical vocabulary is different from descriptive vocabulary will have to be radically different than we see in the normative case. So it'll have something to do with the framework articulating or logical scaffold articulating role of logical vocabulary. So here we get Ryle on conditionals, Sellars on a lot of different vocabularies, Brandom in the talk earlier in the conference and in other places, this distinctive metalinguistic role that's not making the claims out to be about our language, but trying to understand the role of the vocabulary in terms of articulating the framework in which we can think thoughts at all or think descriptive thoughts at all. So that would be, I mean, I think that's in some ways the way Bob's thinking of logical expressivism is in this fairly different way from the way both Blackburn and Gibbard, or both first path and second path expressivists, are thinking of their expressivism about normative terms. Well, let me just think out loud with you a bit about some possible new names. So all this approach bears similarities to expressivism, especially as it's reached by the second path. Its differences tend to make the name misleading, especially among meta-ethicists who are steeped in the first and second path to expressivism. The core idea vaguely stated is that some words are not mainly for describing the properties of things we can encounter in reality, but rather for providing or articulating the logical framework or the conceptual scaffolding of various discursive practices, including but perhaps not limited to the practice of describing states of affairs in the world. So some suggestions about what you might call it. It's a kind of logicism about logical vocabulary, or pragmatism about logical vocabulary, or it's a logical pragmatism in the sense that you see the target vocabulary, whatever it is, and in the original case it's logical vocabulary, but it could also be modal vocabulary or normative vocabulary or other vocabularies, as playing an essential logical role in that it's framework articulating or scaffolding instituting. So just to run through two cases where I think this works fairly clearly, and then think about how it applies to the modal and the normative cases, and then I'll quit. So I suspect a lot of philosophers are actually unreflective pragmatist, logical pragmatists about traditional logical vocabulary. This shows up in the quote from Sellars as well, where he talks about the empiricist's assumption is that any vocabulary that's not descriptive or logical is inferior. So they assume that there is this difference between descriptive and logical, and it's just that they can't figure out where normative vocabulary fits in. But I think it's considerably strained to think of logical vocabulary like the biconditional as describing a real relation holding between propositions on the model of Hugh is sitting in front of Paul. That's not to say that we couldn't represent it with a binary relation so that it's expressing a relation in a mathematical sense. but I think it's wrong to think of it as describing a relation, a real relation in the world. And I think it borders on absurdity to think that the word exists describes a real property, or the phrase is identical to describes a real relation. Of course, again, we can use the mathematical sense of a unary or binary function to represent those, but describing the relations in the world is taking things too far. There are, of course, some people who are into heavy-duty metaphysics who would like to see even those as descriptive, but I think that's wrong. Another case, then, is semantic minimalists, so people who think that we shouldn't think of the truth predicate in terms of its ability to let us describe a property in the world, truth, but instead in terms of its ability to let us make certain kinds of generalizations. Here I think people are somewhat more self-consciously logical pragmatist, as I'm using the term, about traditional semantic vocabulary. So the truth predicate's not normally thought to be part of traditional logical vocabulary, but it's closely related. So the thought here is that you get something like this idea of logical pragmatism about traditional logical vocabulary, of course, and then also maybe mild extensions into things like the truth predicate and terms like proposition. Now, can we extend it further? Well, the modal case would be one where my idea is that a lot of people who are attracted to expressivism in the modal case, what they're really after is something like what I'm calling logical pragmatism. They're attracted to the idea that the modal vocabulary plays this essential framework explicating or logical scaffold instituting role in our discourse rather than a descriptive role in our discourse. And I think it distorts the issue to try to force that view into either the first or the second path of expressivism, to think that that means that the logical or the modal vocabulary, modal claims essentially express motivational potentials or desire-like attitudes seems wrong to me. Similarly, even if we say that there's a plurality of different functional roles, to think that we have to understand the modal claims as expressing some state of mind with a functional role other than cognitive representation of reality. I mean, I think I agree with that. It's just that I think that that way of putting the point makes opaque some of the motivation for thinking about being some kind of anti-descriptivist about modality. So we should instead say that the target species of modal vocabulary is, in the relevant sense, logical. Now, this would be a broader sense than the traditional logical vocabulary, but the thought is that this vocabulary serves not to describe states of affairs in the world, but to articulate the conceptual scaffolding within which descriptive practice takes place. Now, final place to go back to where we started in the normative case, because this works similarly. So the view I'm attracted to in metaethics is one that treats various normative vocabularies along the logical pragmatist lines. At least I think explicitly normative modals like ought, must, and may are first and foremost modal words and their deontic uses, and in their deontic uses we should view them as articulating the logical framework or conceptual scaffolding of practical reasoning and discourse. Again, it seems wrong to me to distort the issue if we force the view into the modal of expressivism. Definitely in the first case, where we think that these words have to express as part of their semantic content, we have to line them up with desire-like states of mind. Along the second path, I'm a little bit more irenic. I think there's something right about the second path to expressivism, but maybe this is really the thing that second path expressivists about normative modals would like to get at, is this idea that they play this essential framework explicating role in practical thought. But at the same time, it seems to me that this is, so insofar as this is a move beyond expressivism, it's not a move back to descriptivism. We're seeing normative vocabulary, especially the normative modals, as playing a essentially different role from descriptive vocabulary. It's a role much more like traditional logical vocabulary than like either the kind of emotive vocabulary that people like Ayer appeal to, or even the kind of plan-like attitudes that people like Gibbard appeal to. It's one where the role of the vocabulary is to articulate certain conceptual relations between other things that we say and do. So I'll just conclude then with another quote from the same Sellers paper. And I don't know if I've taught you this or anybody else has taught you this, but we've learned that the hard way that the core truth of emotivism is not only compatible with, but absurd without ungrudging recognition of the fact, so properly stressed, if misassimilated to the mode of describing by the ethical rationalist, that ethical discourse, as ethical discourse, is a mode of rational discourse. So my idea here is that the core truth of emotivism is that the normative modals play a logical role in at least practical thinking, if not thinking more generally, and all the other stuff about emotivism we might want to get rid of. Thanks.
Thank you, Matthew. Questions now. Let's see. Amy first, Paul second. Other people, please keep your hands up.
Yeah, thank you. That was great. I agree with what you had to say.
Thanks. Yeah, so I guess I think the proper way to think about it, and I was probably fairly sloppy in the talk, is that the use of the sentences expresses mental states quite generally, but the question is, should we think that the mental states that they express, should we think that appeal to the mental states that they express is the best way of articulating their semantic content? And on the second path, I think the answer to that's no. So you can say they express whatever mental states you want to say they express. They're also going to, the sentences that you use in expressing those mental states are going to express propositions. And then we can talk about why it is that they express that proposition instead of some other proposition and what their role is in our discourse more generally. And there'll be some, you know, you might want to appeal to the mental state they express in some broader story of their connection to other things we think and know and do. But the key is to get away from thinking of that as a semantic description of their content.
Okay, so you think the second path is already sort of getting away from that one core role already?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Since I understood the second path, yeah. And, you know, sort of in my reading of the same people, and I didn't know if you were seeing them.
Yeah,
so
I think...
Yeah,
well, so I think in the normative case, and this is part of the reason these often get kind of run together, people like Blackburn and sometimes I think people like Hugh still want to say, well, what's distinctive about normative vocabulary is that it lets us express this state of mind, this motivational. And that might be one of the distinctive features of some normative vocabulary. But that's not, for them, I think, the reason that the vocabulary is not descriptive. Because they'll say, yeah, in modal vocabulary, it doesn't let you... express a desire, but it does something different. And logical vocabulary does something different, and it's you get this plurality of different things that they can do. But in the specific case of the normatives, or maybe in the modals, or sorry, moral normativity, you get this. Well, and the different thing is expressing a kind of pressure on action, and that's important for certain kinds of explanations of why we're motivated to do what we think is right and wrong and stuff like that. But that's very specific in the moral case and doesn't necessarily extend to the modal. So second path expressivism is meant to be a way of approaching language that allows for sort of that stuff in the moral case, but also other stuff in other cases. And I take it the key move is to think that stuff in the moral case doesn't determine semantic content. It's not your story about what the semantic content is. Whereas in Gibbard's case, and I think Gibbard's much less inclined to extend expressivism to modals, for example, precisely because he thinks, well, in order to do so, you have to say the modals express plans. And it's not, I mean, that's a much more controversial claim.
Okay, so now I've got on the list Paul, John McFarlane, Bridge, and Ray Langton. If there's anybody whose hand I missed, please put it up here.
Yeah, Matthew, that was great. I think very sympathetic.
Good.
So to begin with, I don't see why you think there's something wrong with the expression two paths expressivism, because the destinations are so completely different from one another that they make sense to call them both expressivism or any other thing. They seem to me rather to be two paths away from the same thing.
Two paths away from emotivism.
Two ways of trying to deal with the Frege Geech problem. But they end up in completely different places.
Yeah.
I prefer to use expressivism for the first one, because after all, lots of those people called it, so they have the right to name their own position. Gibbard and at least early Blackburn. What was characteristic, as you said, is that normative beliefs reduced to mental states aren't beliefs, desire and things. And so the view that you need a meaning is completely different. You know, you have to have sentences not associated with propositions, as you said. A lot of hard work needed to try and explain how to get some compositional account that sort of models ordinary reasoning and trade essence problems with it, point out. In the end, you only get some kind of quasi validity, quasi realism. So, it's a very distinctive package of things. And you don't, and the second track, the second part, isn't anything like that at all. I mean, there I think, one can get some inspiration from the from even Davidson,
yeah.
The enemy, who says that, look, we just have a view, an account of how language can be compositional. And his view is truth conditional.
Yeah.
How you get the truth conditions of sentences out of the reference of words. That works beautifully, independently of how the words come to mean what they mean.
Yep.
I think in Truth for Meaning, it explicitly says, well, good, for instance, works the same way as
yep.
red, you know, in terms of what you're calling semantics as
yep.
opposed to metasemantics.
Yep.
How truth conditions are explained by the meanings of words.
Yep.
And that's carried over in the second part. The issue is, different vocabularies. The words can get their meanings radically different ways.
Yep.
You know, maybe red gets its meaning because you say that's red when you have certain kinds of experiences or when you're in front of red things. Whereas maybe, you know, good gets its meaning just in a cartoon version because you are inclined to accept X is good when you like X. You know, so they get their meanings in different ways, but the compositionality and reasoning is no problem. There's no problem about calling everything descriptive. So it's really a completely different position.
Yeah.
Well,
I take most of what you say as friendly, and I mean, obviously, at the end, I was kind of struggling for some other terminology that we might think about. Using instead of expressivism, because I think that actually all the quotes I gave are from Blackburn's Spreading the Word. So I think he's even there already in the second, what I'm thinking of is the second path. I mean, he sometimes oscillates back and forth a little bit between first path and second path. At least that's my reading. But even there, he's already, I mean, when he first introduces the idea of quasi-realism, he's surveying the not just normative words, but modal words and causal words and probabilistic words and things like that, and says, well, what do you do when you're faced with this diversity of different words and the kind of uniformity of a truth conditional semantics? Well, maybe you need to develop some other kind of count. So, but, I mean, I call it a path to expressivism because I think expressivism in meta-ethics often gets... expressivism is the view that Blackburn and Gibbard sort of agree on. And it looks to me that they actually have quite different commitments that are behind the view. And then, I mean, also, I think Hugh calls himself an expressivist about these various things. And then Bob calls himself an expressivist about logical vocabulary. So it's, yeah, I mean, you could say these are three different views. Or you can say, look, there's, I kind of want to say there's two different views, two different paths to the first view, expressivism. Which, of course, has different commitments depending on how you get there. And then there's this other view about where you're focused on vocabularies and like logical vocabulary, modal vocabulary, not on full claims and the mental states they express. But most of what you say I'm very sympathetic to. One thing about the Davidson on good and truth conditions. So I think there's sometimes a tendency along the second path to think that the project of articulating the propositional contents of various normative, modal, and descriptive claims is trivial. And I think that's wrong. And I think, in fact, by getting clearer on the correct articulation of the propositional contents of deontic modal claims, we can gain certain clues into the way to think about the external questions about genealogy and pragmatics. So, for example, the fact that, I mean, I think it's a debate whether you should think of the word ought as always a propositional operator, or sometimes a relational predicate, or sometimes operating on something else. And that's a debate, I think, within not just Davidsonian, but within theoretical semantics about how to assign the propositional contents, which itself can then inform the broader project of, or the what Blackburn was calling external questions of explaining why it is that words like this do this. But that's just a comment about, I think there's some, by making the meta-semantic, the semantic distinction like I do, there's sometimes a tendency to say, well, and then the semantic stuff, that's trivial. It's really the meta-semantic stuff that's the hard and interesting stuff. And I think actually both are interesting and they interact in important ways.
I'm just going to give myself a finger at this point for a quick one.
I think Paul's way of putting it, the two views is two ways of running away from the same place is kind of nice. I mean, the place they're running away from is not emotivism, it's representationalism. And all three views are all running away from that. So when I've used the term global expressivism, what I had in mind was expressivism as an alternative to representationalism, particularly in the kind of explanatory senses that we've been talking about. I'm happy to accept that in some ways it's an unhappy term because it has more specific connotations associated with expressing mental states, but you know, I was explicitly using it in this other sense. I think pragmatism is probably a better term, although I kind of urge you to leave off the logical because that's tying your hands. Once you have this pragmatist framework, then some of the vocabularies you want to apply it to will presumably not be of this logical kind.
Mm.
So the general category is the pragmatism.
Yeah, I think the logical for me is in relation to the deontic modals. So I think I want to think of modals as playing a logical role, and then the deontic modals is a species of that. So they're also playing a logical role. I mean, logical in this, they help to articulate conceptual frameworks rather than add empirical content to conceptual frameworks. But you're right, then you might go to causal or other things where...
I think causal would probably be unlikely to be
So
pragmatism might then come to be qualified by terms which pointed to other kinds of important groups of functions that concepts or terms could have. Yeah, so I think that's right. But the other thing I wanted to say, again, picking up on the Davidson stuff, and related to some points which I think need to be made a bit more explicitly. I think one of the things you have to do here is just to recognize that the project of specifying contents is an ambiguous one, and it has at least two perfectly good kind of readings, but they just need to be kept apart. And one of them is the kind of Davidsonian reading where you're interested in a project of radical interpretation, roughly speaking, as it were, mapping the concepts of other people into your own concepts, and that's entirely blind to these sort of functional distinctions we're talking about. I mean, I take it, Davidson's point. But then there's the project of understanding how we come to have concepts of these various kinds, and that's where the pragmatic work gets done. Now, these are not, it's not that one's the right project and one's the wrong project. They're both interesting projects, they're just different projects.
I guess I'm thinking of semantics as doing something slightly less than just slightly different than mapping terms of some foreign language into your language,
doing it in a way which makes the compositional structure.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, so I think you want to find a perspicuous representation of the propositional the structure of the proposition expressed by the sentence that can explain things, not just how we can understand what somebody else means, but also how sentences that have very similar logical forms compute their meaning in the same way, how there's certain synonymy and entailment relations, things like that, which I see as part of the project of theoretical semantics.
Yeah, but all of that can be on the side, with the sort of Davidsonian side, which is blind to the other stuff.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, John.
Okay, well, first a clarificatory question, then depending on what you say, I might have another question.
Okay.
So this might be the same as Paul's question, but What is the task that these two kinds of expressivism are trying to do, and that your beyond third way is doing better? I mean, is there a succinct way to describe what that task is?
Yeah, I guess that was my attempt at the beginning with the two claims of expressivism vaguely construed was there's a philosophically important difference between types of vocabulary. The original distinction is normative and or moral and empirical, or normative and matter factual, and that distinction is so important that somebody doesn't count as understanding the meaning of the terms if they don't implicitly track it. And so then the project is how do you characterize that distinction such that it meets those two constraints?
Okay, so it's just that there is some distinction between, say, normative terms and descriptive terms such that you don't really understand the meaning of these unless you are aware of the distinction.
Yeah. And I think there's at least three, there's at least three ways of articulating that distinction that are different, and so their benefits and liabilities line up differently.
Okay. But that seems like a very plausible claim, but there there might be many different such distinctions, and I can think of many different views that would recognize distinctions of that kind.
Yeah.
But just to get clear, so being an anti-descriptivist is not part of the project description, then, as you see it?
No, I guess the way I was thinking that the first claim is that the distinction is between, so yeah, right. If all it is that there's an interesting distinction, a philosophically interesting distinction that's relevant for meaning between vocabulary A and vocabulary B, then that is going to apply all over the place. So the key was that vocabulary B is the type of vocabulary we think of as essentially caught up in describing the world.
Yeah.
If you're going to find a philosophically interesting distinction from that, it's going to have to be something that's not descriptive.
Okay, so then the way you're thinking about the project, if you go this way of saying what's distinctive about the modal vocabulary is that it's logical vocabulary, you essentially need to be committed to this claim that you make that no logical vocabulary has a descriptive role.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Because that seems like a somewhat implausible claim to me, though. I mean, there exists an X, there exists a Y, X not equal to Y. You just said something very minimal that could describe a situation that at least two objects in. And I mean, that's not a very heavy-duty description, but
right.
I just don't see why one should deny that that's performing a descriptive role. Saying that it is perfectly compatible with saying the sorts of things that Bob says about the expressive role of logical vocabulary.
Yeah. So I guess there's a move in the way I think expressivists are thinking about their way of cashing out that distinction to the way I was with this idea of logical pragmatism that's crucial here. So the move is from talking about full claims and whether they express beliefs or desires or they express cognitive representations of the world or something else, and talking about specific terms. And so the thought is that when you make that move, you could see that even in the kind of case that you've just articulated, the role of there exists is different than the role of whatever the predicate is that you're using to characterize the thing that exists. That there exists plays a logical role, whereas the predicate plays a descriptive role. So you look at the specific terms and ask whether they, I mean, maybe another way to put this is, do they contribute descriptive or empirical content, or do they provide a way of logically operating on that content? So the thought would be at the kind of most logically basic level, we just have predications of something, some empirical property of some object. But then you can do all sorts of logical operations on those things, and we should understand the role of the first thing, the predication, in a different way than we do the second thing, the logical operations.
Mike.
So it's just a sort of short footnote about Schroeder, which I know you're aware of, and then a diagnostic question about Gibbard. So the footnote is just that Schroeder's book, which I agree is very commendable and interesting, he, as I know you know, explicitly puts to one side so-called hybrid versions of expressivism. He has other objections to those kind of approaches. That is views according to which you take this ideationalist expressivist theory, but you say that normative claims express belief, desire, composites, and not simply desires. And while he has objections to those views, they're very different from the kind of objections you find in the book, where you get this increasingly Baroque view, which doesn't distinguish the normative from the descriptive. They appear elsewhere, and I think they're much less forceful. Since that's viewed dear to my own heart, I wanted to put that dialectical point on the table explicitly. Then the diagnostic question about Gibbard is, I wonder whether the reason he's not more tempted by the second path is that he's perhaps more tempted than, maybe Blackburn is even, by some kind of strong form of metaphysical naturalism. In particular, a kind of subject naturalism is a starting point in Hughes' useful terminology. And I think that the worry would be about the second path is that in its most well-worked out form, Bob's version, there's, on the face of it anyway, unreduced talk of normative proprieties. And for Kripke-Steinian reasons, there's a resistance to any attempt to spell that out in a metaphysically reductive way. And there might be a suspicion by Gibbard that if you tried to spell that out, you'd have to, maybe you'd end up with some sort of strong analytic synthetic distinction that he's nervous about, particularly in the normative case for familiar reasons. but that if you could pull off the kind of rapprochement that Hugh, I think, nicely tries to pull out in his Expressivism in Two Voices paper, he might be much more tempted by that, and maybe, perhaps implicitly, Blackburn takes that view or is less concerned about naturalism. So just the need for a broader metaphysical naturalism seemed kind of off stage, and I wondered to what extent that was maybe what's driving Gibbert, and certainly he emphasizes in his work the way in which he can fit our practice of making normative judgments into a broadly naturalistic metaphysical framework.
Yeah. On the first point, yeah, I mean, obviously you're right that Schroeder explicitly sets aside the sort of hybrid view that you defend. And as you also know, I think that view runs into similar sorts of problems at a sort of later stage in the semantic analysis and assigning semantic contents. But we have to work through a lot of the details like Schroeder does for more traditional expressivism to see how that works. On the Gibbert diagnosis, I don't know. I mean, maybe you're right about the diagnosis. Let me just say two things, though. I mean, the one thing is that, you know, the new book Gibbert's working on is about what seems to be the irreducible normativity of meaning, and I'm not sure. I don't know the book well enough to know whether he thinks that every normative term that you might appeal to in the full theory of meaning could be cashed out in naturalistic terms.
I frame the question in terms of metaphysical naturalism. Mm. So in the book, he distinguishes naturalism about normative concepts, which he rejects. That is, you can't conceptually reduce, but he thinks, just as he thinks in Thinking How to Live, that there is a naturalistic fact about what the thing to do is. It's just that our normative concepts can't be reduced.
Yeah.
But within this framework, it's going to turn out that if you're a planning agent, you'll be committed to there being a naturalistic specification of the thing to do. Similarly, in the case of meaning, there'll be a naturalistic specification of the thing to think, which for him is going to turn out to constitute meanings properly understood. So I think the new book, while interesting in its attempt to move this expressivism into the theory of meaning itself, is still compatible with a metaphysical naturalism in a way that I think he might be worried that the second path will make harder to sustain.
Yeah, and I guess my stance is I just don't see why the second path isn't entitled to the same sort of metaphysical naturalism as far as we want it or could get it.
That's what I tried to spell out in vaguely gesturing towards the appeal to...
But just appeal to conceptually unreduced normative terms in your theory doesn't make you a metaphysical anti-naturalist.
No, but I think he thinks you need to earn the right to using those concepts, because on the face of it, without some special story about what it looks like, they're purporting to talk about some,
But you don't earn the right by conceptually analyzing the terms.
That's not the only way, obviously, but there needs to be, just taking them as primitives in the theory, I think, is what worries him.
Right, but then you'll need some sort of, whatever account he can, if it's not a conceptual analysis that he's offering of the relevant terms, then whatever account he isn't offering, insofar as it's plausible, it seems like it's going to be available to anybody who uses unconceptually reduced normative terms in their account of meaning, which I think a lot of people are going to do. It's only going to be the people who think that you can conceptually analyze all the relevant normative terms and non-normative terms that are opponents.
I think he thinks the ideationalist story he tells is essential to the way you can get metaphysical reductionism without conceptual reductionism, in these cases anyway.
Okay. So.
Right.
Yeah, I think in some ways mine's a follow-up to John's question, but I mean, if you are on the second path to, let's leave aside that it's a different destination, I think it is different, as we were talking about before. If you think that the functional ethical discourse is not to represent, that's compatible with all kinds of rather naive and, from the point of view of many people here, objectionable realist approaches to ethics. I just wanted to get a bit clearer on the implications for that kind of naive realism, because, for example, suppose you had a view about the law, this is just an analogy, according to which when you do your semantics of the law, it's completely obvious that, laws, the enactment of laws is not about representing the world, so it's got a completely different sort of function. Nevertheless, you're a natural law theorist. You're a Catholic natural law theorist. And you think that the law is correct just in case the law that's being proposed agrees with, let's not spell it out in terms of truth, it agrees with the natural law prescribed by God, let's say. So we've got the story about the function being nothing to do with representation, yeah. And yet we have all of this objectionable grand realist stuff about natural law. So what does this second kind of expressivism, how is it an escape from the stuff that Hugh doesn't like? That's one way to put my question.
Because if you thought that the relevant vocabularies were representational, then you would have to say, you would have to be either committed to that metaphysics or adopt some sort of error theory or fictionalism about that metaphysics. But if you think that they're not representational, then you can just remain silent on the metaphysics. So if somebody wants to go on and make controversial, radical, crazy metaphysical claims, your view is not inconsistent with their view. But you're not forced by your view of the function of the relevant language to adopt their view. So yeah, of course, I think all forms of expressivism are consistent with a rapidly robust moral realism. It's just that they give you a way to explain the use of the relevant vocabularies that doesn't commit you to that. If you want to commit to that on some other grounds, then you need to tell us the grounds, and then we can evaluate those grounds. But you can't say you have to be committed to this because you think the relevant sentences are true.
Okay.
I think that's the way that, at least I think about it, and I would guess you think about the realism issue.
What I would be inclined to say is that, if you have one of these cases where, and again, I want to take it back to the explanatory direction issue. You have one of these cases in which you have on the table an explanation for a practice, and particularly the practical significance of the practice, in the pragmatic terms rather than the metaphysical terms. And then someone comes along and says, oh, but surely that's compatible with, the metaphysical story being true too. Then the natural, one reaction is, well, why would you think that, given that the practice, all the ordinary sort of the folk judgments about the area in question and so on, have all been adequately explained in this other way? Doesn't the metaphysical story simply become an idle cog? Now, an idle cog objection doesn't. We don't have a knockdown argument against there being idle cogs in the world. I'm reminded here of something that Richard said in our joint paper, about the world being sadly full of useless things. But the question is why, in a philosophical context, idleness is an important kind of challenge in a philosophical context, because you can say to your opponent, why on earth do you believe that? If they say, well, I just do, then it looks like that's the end of any useful discussion. You haven't got a knockdown argument against them, but you have got a kind of reason for not bothering to pursue the point any further. I wonder if I've got time to... let me just give myself one quick question on the end. I had myself on the end of the list here. Really a two-part thing. The first part is just a comment to say that I was sympathetic to what I take it that John was saying about sort of deflating the notion of descriptive further than you do, so it kind of drops out of the picture as a useful part of the classification.
Then you need some alternative.
No. You've already got all the functional stuff.
But you yourself want to talk then about some kind of tracking relation as...
Well, but yeah, so in some of my more recent stuff, I say, well, look, sure, there may be some kind of tracking notion, which is one kind of functional, one kind of thing which can go in the functional level. But just give up on the idea that that's the... So that may be something driving the intuition that some discourses are genuinely descriptive, but... At least separate it completely from all sort of semantic notions of descriptive. So you're already deflating notions like truth and fact and proposition and so on. Treat the semantic notion of description as something which gets deflated along with that.
Yeah. I guess I'm less willing than you to say that our modal claims describe modal reality. That seems to me to only mislead.
Okay, whereas I think that that's the kind of thing that we can say, as it were, at no cost, if we're already deflating notions like truth and fact and things like that. That may be simply a kind of a sort of issue of preference. But the other thing I wanted to say, again, a small point, is that if you're setting up this nice sort of three-part classification, I think one possibility that you ought to have on the table with respect to the first path is that someone might be a first pather while thinking that it's not the case, and that the traditional first pathers were wrong about this, that the only interest in psychological distinction is a belief-desire distinction. That is, there might be a three-part or a multi-part distinction there. And you know, I can use my own sometime slice of myself as an example, because when I first got into this stuff with respect to probability, before I had the kind of the global revelation. I think I was already clear that credence was not a motivational state. Yeah. It was a sort of decision-related state, but it was important to distinguish it. It was more, in a sense, more on the belief side than on the desire side. Yeah. So,
but I agree with that. I guess I mean this might just be classificatory, but I wasn't thinking of that as first path, because the first path gains its anti-descriptive bona fides by distinguishing sharply between belief-like and desire-like states of mind in terms of their direction of fit with the world. So you get belief-like, you know, try to represent the world, desire-like, try to change the world. And in that kind of bifurcated picture, there's not room for something else. But if you put in a third thing, credences...
But you can then still hang on to all the other commitments at the first level. I mean, all the stuff about the semantics and so on. So it's true that you're giving up something, but you still haven't necessarily moved to the second level, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would actually then kind of radically complicate the ideational and semantic story you wanted to give, because you can, of course, embed probability claims within modal claims or modal claims within probability claims. And now you have sort of three different kinds of states of mind that you're trying to get to systematic and compositional ways with. And it looks like it's not going to just be three, but if it were five, once you think about other...
Exactly. And so that's a reason for giving up on the first path and moving at least to the second.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a kind of motivated reason which comes from pointing out that the assumption that the only interesting psychological distinction was the belief-desire one.
Yeah.
It was one which is, in a sense, blinkered, because it was kind of blind to the other cases in which that sort of traditional expressivism seemed to have something going for it, which is already there in the early logical positivism.
I think then you would need alternative explanations for why these other kinds of states that aren't desires and aren't beliefs are nonetheless not cognitive representations of reality. That would be in the original Humean case, you just think, well, our psychology of the motivation to action includes these two kinds of states with essentially different directions of fit, and it's that direction of fit metaphor that gains you the kind of anti-descriptivism in the normative case. But then if you say these claims express as part of their semantic content credences, then you want to know, well, why is it that credences aren't representational? And you'll just need a different story, but you could come up with one.
Okay, we're out of time. I mean, you could say that if you look at the modal side of Hume, then you've already got an answer to that question. Okay, let's thank Matthew. Now, we've now got a 20-minute morning coffee break, and then we come back for...